Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 13th of April 2014. My name is T.R.P. Watson, and this week I'm joined by Johnny Fox and Phil from the West End Whingers. We're now going to talk about The Beautiful Game, which is at the Union Theatre in Southwark. It's the Andrew Lloyd Webber and Ben Elton musical from 2000, and is here directed by Lottie Wakeham with choreography by Tim Jackson. It's had a strange life since it was first put on in 2000. It ran for about just under a year, I think, and it was not massively successful. I mean, I don't think actually Andrew Lloyd Webber's had a really long-running musical since Phantom of the Opera, perhaps. This one, I think it was fairly well reviewed at the time. It concerns the football team in the Troubles in Northern Ireland, and apparently had a rather downbeat ending at the end of it. It was slightly reworked, or quite well reworked, by Andrew Lloyd Webber and Ben Elton in 2009, and they retitled it The Boys in the Photograph, and apparently gave it a slightly more upbeat ending. But I don't think that this version is it, John? Tell me more about this and what you thought of this production.
First thing I thought about this production was, it's 50 years old, and Andrew Lloyd Webber is still alive and still writing. I think that's quite an unusual set of circumstances for a composer, isn't it? That he's still churning out stuff whilst people are doing a 50th anniversary remake of... Although, except the piece isn't 50 years old. No, I'm teasing. It's set 50 years ago in the Troubles in Belfast in 1969. And I thought it was quite well timed, because isn't this the week also that the Irish president came over to visit the Queen and brought with him Martin McGuinness, who had been commander of the IRA? And I think that's a nice distancing piece of history that makes us realise that most of this trouble, if you like, in Ireland is now behind everybody, and people have largely moved on from it, and we're not under threat of violence or terrorism as we were through the 70s and 80s. What this also made me a little bit confused about is, who is the show intended for? Because in order to enjoy it, you have to be both a fan of Andrew Lloyd Webber and a fan of football. And I'm not sure there's an awful lot of those people about. There certainly weren't enough to fill 70 seats at the Union the night I went, and I'm not sure there will be for the rest of the run either. Don't they say about football, it's a game of two halves? Well, so's this show, but unfortunately I have to sit through a turgid and interminable first half in order to get to the more exciting, more dramatic and more violent second half. So in the first half, it's a rather tedious story of boy gets girl... Oh, sorry, boy plays football, boy flirts with girl, boy gets girl, girl gets pregnant, which is fairly unrelieved by either music or performance. There's a certain enjoyment of the fact that musical theatre chorus boys can look and behave like footballers, and they are fairly convincing. But for me, it was only really relieved by the broad smile and broader shoulders of Stephen Barry, who plays Dell, who is the only Protestant in the all-Catholic football team run by Father O'Donnell. Very, very good performance by Carl McChrystal, by the way. So what happens after the interval is that the main character, John, again, good performance by Ben Kerr, very likeable character who is one of the romantic heroes. He meets a girl, they marry, and their relationship is the core of the piece. And also, he has the biggest dramatic arc to travel, because he's a naive, young, enthusiastic footballer at the beginning, and he's a balaclava-clad terrorist at the end of the show. So in the second half, there is fighting, there is violence, there is kneecapping, there are guns. It is quite an interesting and tense production. Whether that all kind of goes with the slightly Riverdancy, slightly Dana, slightly lilting Irish traditional music, I don't really know. And what it definitely doesn't go with is the over-emphatic Northern Ireland accent into which everybody has been drilled by one vocal coach, so that they all sound exactly the same, and they all sound that they come from the same street in Northern Ireland. Which is fine if they didn't all deliver it at the same pitch as Ian Paisley. So it really is rather over the top. And you sort of long for Dana and her softer Irish lilt. from outer Belfast. She came from Thornhill, where they don't speak quite so aggressively. I'm rambling, really, but it's not bad. It's a good production. It's a good production, as always, with stuff that you find at the Union. Even this, which is a rental rather than a Sacha Reagan homegrown production, you get good, strong performances, kids who can act and dance and sing, and that's about it, really. It's not a great musical, and what has been done to it in the name of renovation by Lloyd Webber and Ben Elton is not really wonderful. The reason it had to be tinkered with is that Lloyd Webber lifted from it the musical theme to a song called Our Kind of Love, or All Kinds of Love, which is now reworked by him as Love Never Dies. It's the same thing, jacked up an octave for Sierra Boggess to deliver in Paint Never Dries. And without that very good song, what's left is not quite so memorable. And I'm trying now very hard to, looking at the list of songs, to remember what any of them sounded like. And I suppose there's a song which is actually the title of the musical when it was performed in America and Australia, which is The Boys in the Photograph. And you might just remember that, but it's not a stamp. There is no takeaway song from this. So a reasonable production. Only go, really, if you're actively interested in either Lloyd Webber or Irish politics or football, but as I say, finding people who have all those three things in common is pretty rare, and I'm not sure it's going to be terrifically successful.
I'm now going to talk about Two Into One at the Menier Chocolate Factory. This is Ray Cooney's 1984 play, which he has directed again, and in fact stars again as a rather crotchety old waiter with kung fu powers. Or so he thinks. It stars Michael Praed, Nick Wilton, and Josefina Gabrielle, amongst others. The idea here is that a Tory MP is staying in a hotel with his wife. He coerces his private secretary to set up an illicit affair in that hotel with a secretary. And, of course, mistakes then follow, and people return from holiday or from going to Evita, and it all goes terribly, terribly wrong in, well, funny-ish ways. This is the odd thing about this play. It's been very well reviewed by a number of newspapers, four-star reviews, people talking about it being a classic farce, and it is definitely very well done, and it is a pretty well-constructed farce. I mean, Ray Cooney can certainly write it. I do have to say, though, that I find his characterisations rather slim, and some of the excuses made by characters are also a little bit thin, and some of the things people pretend to be, like pretending to be doctors, it really doesn't make any sense. Now, normally what people say is, well, that's farce for you. You know, you don't expect strong characters and you don't expect very good motivations, and people just accept things that they wouldn't do in real life because that's what farce is all about. And perhaps I've been spoiled on farce. I remember the first farce I ever saw as an adult was A Little Hotel on the Side, which was John Mortimer's adaptation of a Phaedo play called The Free Enterprise Hotel. And although I saw that in a half-empty Olivier Theatre, Graham Garden on the stage as the main character, I really, really enjoyed it. Now, perhaps I shouldn't have enjoyed it because it was a half-empty theatre, but for some reason I've always remembered that with fondness all those years ago. It must be almost 30 years ago now. And I've always come into farce wanting it to be as good as my memory of that is, and it isn't always the case. I mean, Phaedo I've seen done well, and I've also seen done very badly. And Ray Cooney has always been able to deliver. He knows how to do a funny line, and he knows how to mechanically do a play. I'm just not sure that this play is good enough. The idea we're having is set in 1984, when the play was written, and it feels terribly old-fashioned, and it feels, as I said before, not as full of character as it should do. And people are, they feel very stock. They feel as if, well, of course you're going to recognise these people as you would have done in 1984, because we all knew things like that, because they were very current. But now those characters, they're not quite so current. I mean, we wouldn't perhaps expect a Tory MP to behave like this, or we wouldn't be surprised if a Tory MP behaved like this, but we would see more motivation behind it and something more of a Tory MP of this time rather than one of 30 years ago when the play was written. I think that that's maybe part of this problem, that he relies too much on what the audience already knew at the time, or what was current at the time. And because we have changed and we're different and we look at politics in a different way, it doesn't work quite so well. Now, that said, and even the people who dislike this play, because of course they split the critics, this play, even the people who didn't like this play admit that they were surrounded by people laughing, and perhaps that is part of the problem for them, because it was very easy, I found, with all my reservations about the play, which started very early, I was able to laugh and enjoy myself, and I think that's really what you need when you go to the theatre and see a comedy. But I think if you weren't able to laugh, weren't able to relax into it, I know from experience that can be an extremely bad feeling when you're in the theatre and makes you hate the play you're seeing even more than you might already have done. But yeah, if you went to laugh, you probably would have done. We're now going to talk about Banksy, The Room and the Elephant. This concerns a man who set up a house in an old water tank in L.A. Apparently, Banksy the artist was in Los Angeles for the Oscars, and he sprayed, "This looks a bit like an elephant," on the water tank and instantly made the water tank a work of art. It was then inhabited by a local legend, Chachoa Covington. Sorry, he was already ensconced there.
Living there several years.
Yeah, and this is really his story about people trying to take the art and evict him. And tell me more about this production and what you thought, John.
I just want to explain the provenance of the, you always do that with art, don't you, of the piece. Sometime actor, sometime male prostitute, sometime vagrant, Tacoma Covington, a black man living in California, found an unwanted, abandoned water tank. And just to know what the water tank looks like, it's a long white tube with a protruding pipe, big thick pipe, which turns a 90-degree downward corner at one end of it. And it was parked on a hillside in California overlooking the Pacific. And he began to live in it like a sort of street dweller would, but furnished it with a slightly arty, slightly eclectic interior. And then in, I think, February of 2011, something like that, just over 3 years ago, the artist Banksy was in Los Angeles on other business, and painted in stenciled lettering on the side, "This looks a bit like an elephant," which it does. You can see the photographs in the newspapers. It really, from the distance, you could have joked that. But that wasn't a momentary work with a spray can. The lettering is careful and a little bit organised, and you would have needed ladders and possibly a scaffold tower or something to get up there to do it. So the question that the play we're talking about asks is, what's authentic and what was crafted perhaps between Mr. Covington, the tank resident, and Mr. Banksy, the artist, and what then happened to the piece? Was that also a bit orchestrated in order to develop a news story? In other words, what's real and what's art and what's just commercial? Because what next happened is that a Los Angeles media company called, I almost want to say Perfect Curve, because that's the media company everybody thinks about at the moment. They're not Perfect Curve, but they call something equally stupid. Yes, right. A Los Angeles media company called Mint Currency bought the tank immediately and in a certain degree of secrecy from the city and moved it to secure storage, hoping to resell it as a work of art. That would have worked if Banksy had said, put his hand up and said, "Yes, it was me that what done it." But although it was well known that it was him who had done it and he had admitted to it, he refused to officially authenticate the artwork, and without his endorsement, then the item's value tanked. So rather than just documenting this event as a play, what Tom Wainwright has done, in what is really a thoughtful new piece of writing, does ask these many layered questions. Who was the artist? Banksy for simply lettering the outside, Covington for his eclectic handmade interior. Did Banksy already know about the tank resident? Because Covington had been long the subject of a documentary, and fragments of that had already been posted on YouTube. So you could have argued that, you know, Banksy might have known what was going on. And who exploits whom, and who then gets the credit? One of the nicest sequences in the play is how Gary Beadle, who plays, it's a one-man piece, and the character is called Titus Coventry, spins his attitude to Banksy from starting out very, very accusative to almost reverentially affectionate. Because what happened was that, having decided that the media company were up to no good in moving the piece away from the hillside and into a secure warehouse, Banksy made friends with Covington and gave him enough money to buy a proper apartment for a year and pay all his bills and kind of get himself sorted out. But interestingly, now that that money has gone, and now that the money from the documentary by Dallas photographer Hal Samples, which is also part of this evening's entertainment, you see that after the interval, after the one-man show, now all that money is gone. Mr. Covington has moved back to the hillside and pitched a tent. So it's almost as if the story has come full circle. And circular is really a little bit what the performance is. He's very engaged as an actor, and he's very intense. But he didn't completely hold my attention, even though there's quite a bit of breaking of the fourth wall and he's directly addressing the audience. And I was in the front row, but he must have seen me nod off at one point because I couldn't really keep focused on it. The documentary is more moving, more touching, because it's made over a longer period of time, and perhaps because it breaks out of just this one-man, one-focus story, and you see more other people, more of other situations. There's a quite touching piece in the documentary where they show Mr. Covington a clip of someone acting this story out at the Edinburgh Festival. And again, that's another whole layer of, is it art, is it commercial, is it decent to do this to somebody and their life whilst they're still living it? That was very interesting. Very well attended, sold out, people queuing for returns. Mostly, it has to be said, being that sort of Dalston groove of North London, mostly hip young art types lured by the Banksy name, even though Banksy doesn't feature in either the documentary or the story in any meaningful way as a person, only as other people commenting on what he's done. But yes, a lot of V-necks and Vans and drainpipe jeans and very, very cool seeming people. So a must for them, definitely. And interesting for anybody else. I would have preferred it if, instead of being two separate units, the one-man solo performance and the documentary, there had been a means of intercutting them and perhaps breaking out the solo performance with other characters as well, because I would have loved to have seen some of this from the media company's perspective. I would have loved to have known what went through their minds and what kind of discussions and negotiations they had, even if it were all built on speculation, because apparently they're quite secretive and won't be interviewed on the subject. How did they feel when they got the idea to take the tank down from the hillside? And then again, how did they feel after having made the investment of doing it when Banksy wouldn't endorse what they'd done and they might have lost a lot of money? So lots of interesting things going on, a very interesting project. Not, I think, its best possible realisation. So hopefully someone will take this work, maybe Tom Wainwright himself will rethink this and give us an enlarged and more populated version, which is the thing I would have liked to have seen.
We're now going to talk about King Charles III, which is a new play by Mike Bartlett, a future history play, if you like, at the Almeida, and it is directed by Rupert Gould. It's got quite a good cast, including Tim Pigott-Smith, Oliver Chris, Margot Lester, Lydia Wilson, Nicholas Rowe, Nick Sampson. I'm not going to go through absolutely everybody. Essentially, the story is that the Queen has died and Charles has taken over, become the new king, and one of the first things that lands on his desk is a privacy bill. And he thinks, well, this isn't quite right because it restricts the freedom of the press. He takes a principled stand and refuses to sign, or refuses to give royal assent. Now, this hasn't happened since 1700-whatever. Queen Anne, I think, is the last monarch to refuse assent. And it causes a crisis because it's one of these things that simply doesn't happen. It is a power that the monarch in theory has, and in fact all constitutional monarchs have. I think the King of the Belgians objected to something and refused to sign some bills, and that he sort of either took time off or something. I can't remember exactly what happened a few years back when he objected. But it's not really thought of as binding in any way. It's sort of a ceremonial flourish. And that really starts the debate about the position of the monarchy and the position of the monarch. And he's taking this principled stand against what he really wants is perhaps to have the theoretical advantage of the monarch, which is to sit back and advise, encourage and warn. Not get involved, but simply to advise, encourage and warn. And he finds it frustrating to find that his advice, encouragement and warnings are simply not heeded. They say, we voted on this, it's all gone through, sign. And he doesn't want to. And this provokes a crisis in the country and in his family as well. We also have a subplot of Prince Harry falling in love with a very ordinary girl from, I think it's New Cross. And she's sort of course, Republican, and he drifts into this. But of course, this young woman he's fallen in love with has a history, and there are people who want to exploit her history when she would remain private. And perhaps this privacy bill that King Charles objects to may well have protected her. Phil, tell me more about this and what you thought of it.
Well, I think that the plot, I mean, it's just kind of a what-if, and I didn't actually know that about Queen Anne, that actually had happened before, but I think there was a good point made at one point where Charles is sort of trying to decide whether to sign the assent on the privacy bill. He mentioned something, I think it's him that mentions it, about the Nazi party or something, or would he, you know, would if they'd got to power, would he have signed that? And he is actually encouraged, sort of rather cheekily, by the leader of the opposition. I mean, there's some really dirty goings on in this. I mean, I think it's an absolutely cracking play and a really interesting plot. I was absolutely hooked. It starts off as kind of a cheeky kind of premise with the, you know, obviously with the Queen dying. And I suppose that's probably the controversial kind of thing in a way. And because it's, although it's a future history, it's kind of set tomorrow almost, because Kate and William and Harry are all the ages that we see them at now, Charles as well. So it's kind of supposing the Queen's not going to last much longer. I mean, all that is kind of a little bit tricky, but we know the Queen's going to die one day, and then what happens afterwards? And this takes this sort of imaginary setup, and I think does it brilliantly. If you take the people who are playing the leads of the royal family anyway, and sort of line them up, you'd kind of pick out who they were playing straight away. I believed in them and who they were playing. Maybe not so much with Camilla, although Margot Less is very good and delivers the lines very dryly, but I didn't feel an essence of Camilla in herself. It's incredibly funny at times. Some of the jokes are probably a little bit obvious. Some of them are quite subtle. There's a great sort of kebab as metaphor kind of scene. And I think the whole staging, Rupert Gould has kind of not done his usual gimmicky thing. And yet, the simplicity, Tom Scutt's very simple, stripped back to the bare walls of the Almeida kind of set, and then a purple dais and a sort of a subtly painted frieze behind them, works really, really well. But having said that, the opening scene of the Requiem after the Queen has died, I found that really quite thrilling. And then it just even gets better after that. I think this is this year's Chimerica. I can't see it not transferring to the West End, and I can't not see it winning awards. I was absolutely mesmerised by it.
I was certainly very impressed by it. It's done in blank verse, which occasionally, I don't know whether it was sometimes meant to be funny or whether it was inadvertently funny sometimes. There are a few Yoda-ish lines where, you know, they get the word order wrong and it does sound a bit odd.
My feeling was they were deliberately doing that, because there were times where, for instance, Kate or someone would say something and it almost slipped deliberately into a kind of cod Shakespearean thing, which I think was funny. I mean, I had a problem when I read originally that it was in blank verse. I thought, oh, God, no, this could go either way. But there were times where you didn't really notice, and I think deliberately not notice, it actually sounded like ordinary dialogue. And then occasionally it would slip back quite heavily into a very deliberate blank verse. But that, to me, I don't know quite how they pulled that off, that mix, but it worked for me very, very well.
Yeah,
and the whole Shakespeare parallels anyway with the ghost, and I think the Prince Harry character is probably a reference to Prince Hal, perhaps, or something. There were probably lots of Shakespearean references I didn't even get.
Well, yeah, certainly a lot of the soliloquies, and also I got a lot of echoes of Macbeth, especially with what happens to Charles throughout this play. I mean, we don't want to give too much away, because I think it's a fascinating thing. I think it gets us the idea of the Constitution very right, and does it very cleverly, and does the sort of the difficulties, and again, we don't want to give too much away, because I think it's something that people need to appreciate, because it is, as you say, so good. I mean, it is wonderfully acted, I think. I felt a great treat to see it, even if the person sitting next to me kept bouncing up and down on the seat for some reason.
What, with excitement?
Well, it was just fidgeting, I think. it was a bit odd. Certainly, Mike Bartlett seems to be the playwright at the moment. He can almost do no wrong.
I thought he did very little wrong with this at all. I thought that it actually also brought out the sort of the debate about whether there is a point to the royal family rather well. Without it attacking them, I thought he steered a very clever middle road here. He let you made up your own mind. And it was actually, in many ways, despite some of the things, like Kate being quite scheming, quite affectionate. But even with Kate, he actually presented her as being pretty smart. And you could argue that she's actually looking out for the interests of the family firm, or is she looking out for her own interests, which I think it makes it quite interesting. And again, it's quite difficult to say much more about that without giving away the plot. And then there's the ghost, which I think we can say who the ghost is, because it's every single review has mentioned that it's the ghost of Diana. That's kind of quite naughty, but also quite funny. And the woman playing her, Katie Braben, who plays other characters, I mean, it's quite subtly used, but she has the movement and the kind of the tilted head and a couple of lines which just give you that thing that she's actually manipulating from beyond the grave, which is, that's when it's kind of at its most playful with things like that. And of course it references the ghost in Hamlet. And I just want to also mention Tim Pigott-Smith, who I thought was absolutely brilliant in this. He kind of felt like Prince Charles at first. I mean, he was doing the voice initially, and then he, I think, deliberately dropped it and just concentrated on the performance. And it was a very clever and subtle portrayal of Charles, I think, and the way it was written. It presented him initially as kind of dithering and then being quite strong and wanting to make his mark in a way after, you know, 60 years or so of his mother being on the throne.
Did it change your views of the monarchy? Because I always think of myself as a reluctant monarchist. In other words, I know we should really be a republic and vote for everybody, but if you just replace the monarch with a president with exactly the same powers, nobody would ever bother to vote for the president. It's really just being there and, you know, having a big hat and stuff like that. And
yeah,
I think that this play kind of addresses that as well, you know, that it doesn't really talk about whether or not you should have a president, but it does talk about the idea of what the monarchy should be and whether it should have any actual power.
I mean, my view on them varies. Really, I think, like you know, we shouldn't really have a royal family. And it actually does make you think this is a completely ridiculous situation. And yet, they do provide quite a lot of entertainment, and certainly in this play they have. And I think the whole thing is, it does show them actually to be, it's quite a fascinating institution. It may be slightly bonkers, and it kind of does hint that it's kind of an absurd situation, but it felt that it was saying that without saying we should get rid of them, which is, I suppose, sort of how I feel.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as-yet-unnamed London Theatre Podcast page in Facebook, on the web we are AYULTP.com, and the podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you. Goodbye.